talk. The programming has really grown me, and for those reasons and more, I support WPFW.
And you can support WPFW as well. Keep the calls coming this hour for what would be We the People. We want to make sure that even while David is away, that he makes his goal. The number to call is 800-222-9739. That is, again, 800-222-9739. And most fitting today that we hear something from that gift, the Black August Black Liberation Digipack, yours for a pledge of $150. And we're going to hear right now James Baldwin's speech, The Free and the Brave.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. Today, we continue our celebration of Black History Month with another treasure from the Archives collection that has been recently restored for this broadcast thanks to a grant from the American Archive, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from Pacifica listeners. We're going to dedicate this program to an entire speech by author and essayist James Baldwin.
I prefer to believe that since a society is created by men, it can be remade by men. The price for this transformation is high. White people will have to ask themselves precisely why they found it necessary to invent a nigger.
We have featured the African-American writer James Baldwin before on From the Vault, and today we present another extraordinary instance of Mr. Baldwin on Pacifica Radio, as the African-American sought identity and definition in a world changing before them. The time is April or May of 1963. His book, The Fire Next Time, had just been released, and he is on the road speaking to churches, high schools, Masonic temples, universities, and at Pacifica Radio, both in Berkeley, California, New York, and Los Angeles. In April and May of 1963, Birmingham, Alabama was where the fire was being fueled by white supremacy, where confrontations between African Americans and the police took a violent turn when fire hoses and dogs were released on the people demanding equality. This was just months before the 1963 March on Washington, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech. This program contains Baldwin referring to the African American as Negro and uses the N-word once. We present this program unedited and unvarnished as an example of an era not so far in the distant past, but so close that many of you remember when these terms were not as inflammatory as they are today. Here, Baldwin addresses the congregation of the Second Baptist Church in Los Angeles with a talk he entitles, The Free and the Brave.
Said you better let my people go.
And I want you to somehow make a certain leap with me, because I have one more quotation I want to give you. And this comes from Nietzsche. It comes from Thus Spake Zarathustra, I think. But it's been on my mind all week long. At some point, the man says, I stand before my highest mountain and before my longest journey, and therefore must I descend deeper than I have ever before descended. Now, there's several thousand things that one has got to say in the context that we're speaking, out of which we're speaking. And I suppose the first thing that I have to suggest is that one consider the fact that in the life of a man, the life of a woman, in anybody's life, there are several elements always at work. But the crucial element I want one to consider here is that element of a life which we consider to be an identity. The way in which one puts oneself together, the way one imagines oneself to be, the reality, for example, the invented reality, standing before you now, arbitrarily called Jimmy Baldwin, who contains a great many other things. We have agreed, we have succeeded in striking a certain kind of bargain with the world. This is his name, and this is what he does, and this is who he is. Okay, but that's not it. Beneath that, forever, for everybody, is something else. Is a stranger, the stranger with whom one is forced to deal day in and day out, forced, in fact, to discover, forced, in fact, to create as distinct from invent. Life demands of everyone a certain kind of humility, the humility to be able to make the descent that Nietzsche was talking about. There are two ways, I think. I think there are two ways only to achieve a life or a nation. Let us consider, I'll be personal because I think it may be the easiest way for me to say it, and the whole business of communication or communion really is to find some common term to make something mean to you, some roughly what it means to me. In my life, as I am sure in your life, when one is young, one supposes that there is some way to avoid disaster. If I can spell that out, I mean that when one is young, when I was a little boy, for example, I used to tell my mother, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I'm going to go here, I'm going to go there. I'm going to be right, I'm going to be fireman. I'm going to be this. And Mama would look at me and she would say, it's more than a notion. It took me a long time, a very long time, to begin to realize that she was right and begin to realize what she meant. I, like all of us, thought I knew what I wanted, and thought I knew who I was, and thought that I could do it, and we all do this, whatever it was I wanted, wherever I wanted to go, I thought that I could do it without paying my dues. Because of all the things that one cannot imagine, especially when one's young, is how to pay your dues. You don't even know there are dues to be paid. And later on, one begins to discover, and with great pain, and very much against one's will, that if you want something, whatever it is you want, and whatever it is you want at bottom must be to become yourself. There is nothing else to want. Whatever that is, whatever that journey is, one's got to accept the fact that disaster is a condition under which you will make it. The journey, I mean, not make it in the American sense. And you learn a certain humility because the terms that you've invented, which you think describe and define you, inevitably collide with the facts of life. And when this collision occurs, and make no mistake, this is an absolutely inevitable collision. When this collision occurs, like two trains in a tunnel, one's got the choice, and it's a very narrow choice, of holding on to your definition of yourself, or saying, as the old folks used to say, and as everybody who wants to live has to say, yes, Lord, which means to say yes to life. Until you can do that, you have not become a man or a woman. Now, in this country, part of the dilemma, which could become a tragedy, of being what is known somewhat arbitrarily as an American, the collective effort until this moment and the collective delusion until this moment has been precisely my delusion when I was a little boy, that you could get what you wanted and become what you said you were going to be painlessly. Furthermore, if one examines for a second, or if one tries to define the proper noun American, one will discover, first of all, that to be an American means a catalog of virtues. We have something called I Am an American Day, which I gather is meant to reassure everybody. And to be an American in these terms apparently means, check me out, you think about it. Apparently means that though Greeks, Armenians, Turks, Frenchmen, Englishmen, Scotsmen, Italians may be corrupt, sexual, unpredictable, lazy, evil, a little lower than the angels, we are not. Quite overlooking the fact that the country was settled by Englishmen, Scots, Germans, Turks, and Armenians, a little later to be sure. Every nation under heaven is here. And not, after all, for a very long time. I think that it might be useful, in order to survive our present crisis, to do what any individual does, is forced to do, to survive his crisis, which is to look back on his beginnings. The beginnings of this country, it seems to be, it's a banality to say it, but alas, it has to be said. The beginnings of this country have nothing whatever to do with the myth we have created about it. The country did not come about because a handful of people in Europe, various parts of Europe, said, I want to be free, and promptly built a boat or a raft and crossed the Atlantic Ocean. Not at all. Not at all. In passing, let me remark that the word liberty, the word freedom, are terribly misused words. Liberty is a fact which is also used as a slogan, and freedom may be the very last thing that people want. The very last thing. Anyway, the people who settled the country, the people who came here for one reason, no matter how disguised. They came here because they thought it would be better here than where they were. That's why they came. And that's the only reason that they came. Anybody who was making it in England did not get on the Mayflower. This is important. It is important that one begin to recognize this, because part of the dilemma of this country is that it has managed to believe the myth it has created about its own past, which is another way of saying that it has entirely denied its past. And we all know, if we think about it, what happens to a person who is born, let us say, where I was born, in Harlem, and goes through the world pretending he was born in certain place. However odd this may sound, also happens to a nation being, when it finally comes into existence, the achievement of the people who make it up. And the quality of the nation being absolutely at the mercy, defined, dictated by the nature and the quality of the people who make it up. In this extraordinary endeavor to create the country called America, a great many crimes were committed. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear as I can make it, that I understand perfectly well that crime is universal and common. And I trust that no one will assume that I am indicting or accusing. I'm not any longer interested in the crime. People treat each other very badly, and always have, and very probably always will. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about denying what one does, which is a much more sinister matter. We did several things in order to conquer the country. There was, at the point we reached these shores, a group of people who had never heard of machines, or as far as I know, of money. I think we would call them now a backward nation. And we promptly eliminated them. We killed them. I'm talking about the Indians, in case you don't know what I'm talking about. Well, people have done this for centuries, but I hazard, I'll bet you, as you say in Harlem, a fat man, that not many American children being taught American history have any real sense of what that collision was like, or what we really did, how we really achieved the extermination of the Indian, what that meant. And it is interesting to consider that very few social critics, none to my knowledge, but I say very few, have begun even to analyze the hidden reasons that the cowboy and Indian legend is still one of the most popular legends in American life, so popular that it still, from 1963, dominates the television screen. And I suppose, to finish off that particular item or to close it for the moment, that all those cowboy and Indian stories are designed to reassure us that no crime was committed. We've made a legend out of a massacre. In which connection, if I may for a moment digress, there used to be an old joke running around among Negroes. If you remember the Lone Ranger, I think he had a sidekick called Tonto. An Indian. There's always a good Indian. Tonto and the Lone Ranger ran into this ambush of nothing but Indians. And the Lone Ranger said, "What are we going to do, Tonto?" And Tonto said, "What do you mean, we?" Now, slavery, like murder, is one of the oldest human institutions. So we cannot quarrel about the fact of slavery. That is to say, we could, but that's another story. But we enslaved him because, in order to conquer the country, we had to have cheap labor.
And you know, we hate to interrupt James Baldwin. We hate it. But we have to do it because we are in our pledge drive, and we're offering you today a listen to one of just one of the phenomenal entries on this DigiPack. It's called our Black August, because indeed August is Black August and has been always here at WPFW, excuse me, since the inception of Black August. And so it's our Black August Black Liberation DigiPack, and it contains not only this riveting speech by James Baldwin, but you'll hear from Audre Lorde, Sun Ra, Mumia Abu-Jamal, June Jordan, A-Trap Brown, the Soledad Brothers and George Jackson, Gwendolyn Brooks, and at that time, he was called Leroy Jones, doing a poetry reading. You also get the Amiri Baraka collection, the Angela Davis collection. There is so much here, over 50 hours of content that can be yours. And this particular speech, The Free and the Brave by James Baldwin, is a part of this DigiPack for a pledge of $150. So we have a goal of $500 for this hour. Won't you please make that call that makes the difference? Again, normally David Whetstone would be heard here with We the People, but he is out today. And so we are offering you James Baldwin, which we think he would agree with, very much so. And again, part of the Black August Black Liberation DigiPack, $500 to go. That gift is yours for a pledge of $150, and it's downloadable only, we should say. So when you call, please give your email address so we can send you the files. 800-222-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org as we return to James Baldwin, The Free and the Brave.
They could see, they could recognize a man when they saw one. They knew he wasn't, I mean, you can tell. They knew he wasn't anything else but a man. But since they were Christian, and since they had already decided that they came here to establish a free country, and some of them really meant it, by the way, the only way to justify the role this chattel was playing in one's life was to say that he was not a man. Because if he wasn't a man, then no crime had been committed. That is the basis. That lie is the basis of our present trouble. Because that is an extremely complex lie. If on the one hand, one man cannot avoid recognizing another man, it is also true then, obviously, that the man, the black man, who was in captivity and treated like an animal and told that he was one, knew that he was a man and knew that something was wrong. When we got here, those of us who survived the Middle Passage, let me tell you a very small anecdote. I was in Dakar about a year ago in Senegal. And just off Dakar, there is a very small island called Gore, which was once the property of the Portuguese. And it's simply a rock with a fortress. It is the nearest, from Africa, the nearest point to America. On this island, my sister and I went to this island. They had something called the slave house, and we went there to visit it. And the house is not terribly large. Looks a little like houses you see in New Orleans. That's the truth. It's about two stories, courtyard, staircase on each side, stone staircase. And the bottom section, which is the first story, I assumed that the captains and the slavers were upstairs. Downstairs were the slave quarters, which were, you walked through a kind of archway. On either side of you, very dark, very low, and this is made of stone, were a series of cells on either side. Stone floor, still rusted iron in the walls. It seemed to me, though this may be my imagination, but it seemed to me that I could still smell it, what it must have smelled like with all those human beings chained together in such a place. And I remember they could not speak to each other because they didn't come from the same tribe. On either side, as I say, in this corridor, there are the cells. But straight ahead of you, you're coming through this archway, and straight ahead of you is a very much smaller doorway made of stone, which opens on the sea. You go to the edge of the door, and you look down, and at your feet are some black stones, the form of the Atlantic Ocean, bubbling up against you. And the day that I was there, that we were there, I tried, but it's impossible. Because the ocean is just the horizon. I tried to imagine what it must have felt like to find yourself chained and speechless, no serious sense of that word, on your way where?
You are listening to The Free and the Brave, a speech by James Baldwin on From the Vault. For more information or to get a copy of this program or other programs in this series, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. You can research our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to our program. In this next segment, we listen to author James Baldwin field questions from the Congregation of the Second Baptist Church in Los Angeles, April 1963.
It was the black man's necessity, once he got here, to accept the cross, to somehow manage to outwit his Christian master, because what he faced when he got here was really the Bible and the gun. And that's all right, too. What is terrible in it is the fact that American white men are not prepared, first of all, to believe, for example, my version of this story, to believe that it happened. In order to avoid believing that, they have set up in themselves a fantastic system of evasions, denials, and justifications, which destroyed, or is about to destroy, their grasp of reality, which is another way of saying their moral sense. What I'm trying to say is that the crime is not the most important thing here. What makes our situation serious is that we have spent so many generations pretending that it did not happen. If you doubt me, ask yourself, on what assumption rests, on what assumptions rest those extraordinary questions that white men ask? No matter how politely, on what assumption rests the question, would you let your sister marry a white man? It's based on some preoccupation in somebody's mind. God knows, you know, I have never given any evidence of having that particular problem. I'm not interested in marrying your sister, my God. I mean that. On what assumption, again, rests the extraordinary question, what does a Negro want? This again comes out of some extraordinary preoccupation in the mind. Something entirely, if I may say so, divorced from reality. It's like saying, what do seals eat, or I don't know. It's as unreal can be. When a baby cries, you don't ask the baby what it wants. You find out, you know, you change the baby's diaper. That's what you do, you know. You don't run to your next door neighbor and say, what does my baby want? Now let's go back for a minute to where I started. Let's go back to Nietzsche. I stand before my highest mountain and before my longest journey, and therefore must I descend deeper than I've ever before descended. And we spoke a little earlier about the necessity when the collision between your terms and life occurs of saying yes to life. That's the descent. The difference between a boy and a man is that a boy imagines there is some way to get through life safely. And a man knows he's got to pay his dues. In this country, the entire nation has always assumed that I would pay their dues for them. What it means to be a Negro in this country is that you represent, you are the receptacle of, you are the vehicle of all the pain, disaster, and sorrow which white Americans think they can escape. This is what is meant, really what is meant, by keeping a Negro in his place. It is why white people, until today, are still astounded and offended if by some miscalculation they are forced to suspect that you are not happy in your place. This is absolutely true, and I'm not talking about the Deep South. People finally say to you, but you're so bitter. There's been in this country for a dangerously long time two levels of experience. One, to put it cruelly, but I think quite truthfully, can be summed up in the image of Doris Day and Gary Cooper. I think you know what they do. And the other, subterranean, indispensable, but denied, which can be summed up, let us say, in the tone of Ray Charles. And there's never been in this country any real confrontation between these two realities. Let me force you, or try to force you, to observe a paradox. Though all white Americans, in essence, essentially came from Europe, it is only American Negroes whom Europe understands. Let me spell it out. When an American Negro is in Europe, he and the people whom he finds himself among are able to establish a dialogue which white Americans have great difficulty establishing, if they ever do. And the reason is very simple. The European and the black American know what it is to suffer, and Americans don't. Now the bill for this endeavor to get from the cradle to the grave, looking like Eisenhower, has now come in. White people are astounded by Birmingham. Black people aren't. White people are endlessly demanding to be reassured that Birmingham is really on Mars. They don't want to believe, still less to act on the belief to what is happening in Birmingham. Now I mean this, and I am not exaggerating. There are several thousand ways to kill a man. There's several thousand ways to be violent. They don't want to realize that there is not one step, one inch, morally or actually, there is no distance between Birmingham and Los Angeles.
And again, listening to James Baldwin's The Free and the Brave, part of the Black August Black Liberation Digipack. We're offering this summer pledge drive. And that is yours for a pledge of $150. And I would say that Baldwin's words are as prescient now as they were at the time that they were delivered. And many of the things he's imparting in this speech could be imparted. You can substitute names of cities, countries, and it would be equally as resonant and relevant today. Again, part of the mission here of WPFW, which is to educate. And certainly listening to the words of James Baldwin firsthand, not someone telling you about the words of James Baldwin, but hearing him in his voice impart these words is part of that education. 800-222-9739, or you can go to WPFWFM.org. Again, the DigiPack contains 50-plus hours of content. And James Baldwin, this entry is just one of those 50-plus hours. 800-222-9739, $500 to go. You can also go online to WPFWFM.org if you prefer to pledge on the web. But please make that call that makes the difference. You would be hearing David Whetstone's We the People in this hour. However, he is out today. And so we took that opportunity to offer James Baldwin, who is always relevant, always right on time. And today is no different. So we're going to return. We will return now to that speech, but we implore you to get us started. Someone has to get us started. Won't you be the first one? $500 to go for this hour and 18 minutes to do it. We can do it together, folks. 800-222-9739.
Some of it already, which is to allow the white citizen his first awkward steps toward maturity. But we have functioned in this country precisely that way for a very long time. We were the first psychiatrists in this country. If we can hang on just a little bit longer, all of us, we may make it. We've got to try. And I think that those are the conditions. Thank you.
First, I must report that there were over 100 questions asked, and we selected those that we thought were more pertinent, and also that those that put aside those who were duplicates. The first one, Mr. Baldwin, reads, could you please comment on the Muslim situation and the significance of their movement?
The question about the Muslim movement posed to James Baldwin in this 1963 visit to the Second Baptist Church in Los Angeles is interesting in that in 1961, just a few years prior to that, James Baldwin debated Malcolm X on a program called Muslims versus the Sit-ins and is preserved in the Pacifica Radio Archives.
The significance of the Muslim movement, it would seem to me, first of all, well, this is a complicated question and a complicated answer. A, the Muslim movement came about, exists, and begins to flourish because the American Republic has never honored any of its promises, repeat, any of its promises to its black citizens. That is its first significance to me, in my mind. It has another significance. It is, at the moment, probably the only way that a black boy or a black girl let me go back it is probably if not the only way one of the only ways that a black boy or a black girl can be invested with a pride in the fact of being black. And this is extremely important. The entire country, having lied, in fact, the entire white civilization, having lied about black people so long, until this very moment, this was absolutely inevitable. Now, I have no objection to that. See. This begins my objection. I am perfectly aware, or imperfectly aware, but I was born in a ghetto, raised there, and in fact I never left it. Really, no Negro ever does, if he stays in this country. I am perfectly aware, I think, of the demoralization and the despair and the destruction which is being bred in those ghettos every single hour of every single day. And I know how hard it is for any black person in this country to arrive at any sense of his own value. And yet, there are two ways to arrive at this sense. And this is perhaps rather subtle. I don't think it is, but perhaps it is. Anyway, I think one of them is false, and one of them is true. What white people have done for all these generations is lie about themselves. And they have put on the color of their skin a totally false value. They have said, in effect, for 2,000 years, that they are better than everyone else in the world because they are white. And look at them. Look at the result. The spiritual, the actual political result is nothing more or less than a moral and a spiritual bankruptcy. Because it is not true that the color of the skin has any importance at all in a human life. Now, I know that it seems to, and I know that people have perished because of the color of their skin. But it is not because of the color of their skin, really. It is because of the value placed on it. Is because of what it means in the eyes of someone else or in their own eyes. I want, from the very bottom of my heart, that black people in this country arrive at a real sense of who they are. And I also understand that life being what it is, and power being what it is, that it is entirely possible that the world will have to align itself for the next 2,000 years on the basis of color with the roles reversed. Speaking only for myself, I would not like to see this happen. Speaking for myself, my objective to the Muslim movement is twofold. I do not see that they have an articulate program, by which I mean such things as a rent strike in Harlem. I mean a real revolution, and I do not want my nephew or my brother or my son to begin to believe that he is better than white people because he is black. I don't think that one needs to invent, I do not think the Negro people in this country have any need to invent a reason to be proud. They have achieved already. I know this is a hard saying, but this is true. They have achieved and endured and survived and triumphed over and turned to their advantage already one of the cruelest inflictions in the history of mankind. I think that we have every right to be proud, that our mothers and our fathers our forebears carried washing on their heads, and even to be proud, I hope you understand what I mean, that they knew how to say yes sir and no ma'am and get what they wanted anyway, that they outwitted this civilization to the extent that they took that cross, and made it something it had never been before in this country. And they took that anguish and turned it into music. And they are the only people in this country, on the basis of the evidence, who have been able to produce children to walk through mobs to get to school. They are the only people in this country so far as a body who seem to have any sense of what America is about. And the American Revolution, if I may say so, depends entirely at the moment on their energy. Now this is a tremendous heritage, and I would not like to throw it away for an invented one.
And we just want to interrupt one more time to say thank you to some folks. Thank you to Joelle Laguerre, and that's a new member. Thank you, Joelle, for joining us. Also to Muiza, our dear Muiza Muntali. We'll be hearing from him with Africa Now. He and his co-producer, James Pope, at 1 p.m. Thank you for your pledge of support, Muiza. And we want to say thank you to S. Robert Morgan of Washington, D.C., picking up that Black August Black Liberation Digipack. I want to remind you that when you pledge for that, please leave your email address, because it is a downloadable gift only. So thank you so much. Please keep the calls coming. We have about 8 minutes left, and we still want to get to the goal here. We want to exceed the goal here. The number to call is 800-222-9739 to exceed this goal. Let's make David Whetstone proud this morning. Clarence the Blues Man Turner is in the house and ready to take the board at noon. And at 1 p.m., of course, Muiza Muntali comes your way with Africa Now. 2 p.m., Shai Wanana, Mint and Tea in Arabic with Zain El Amin. And at 3 p.m., the oldest continuously running women's radio collective, Sophie's Parlor. All right here for you at WPFW. Keep those calls coming, 800-222-9739. A little bit more of James Baldwin here. You can still pick up the Digipack all day, all throughout this week. You can get it, but after this week, no. No. Make sure you give your email address if you would like that gift. And again, the number, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. We love you so much. And we stay in this work. We, you know, stay on the battlefield because of you. We are grateful.
Speaking honestly, for example, and this is a very important example, but it's only an example. There are many, 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 many others. We can't stay here all night. I don't know, so far, a single Negro who knows for what reason he would go to Cuba to free the Cubans.
The next two questions I will ask Mr. Baldwin to ask together. The first one, what specific action can the Caucasian American take to achieve full human dignity. The next one, what specific political action can the Negro take to achieve full human dignity?
I don't want to sound cruel. I'm not trying to be malicious, and I'm not trying to be clever. But it seems to me the first question especially, what specific action can the Caucasian American take to achieve full human dignity, occurs to me as being somewhat pathetic. I mean that. If I may be allowed to be rude for a moment, not very rude, but I'm trying to make a point. It reminds me of those people who run to doctors or other friends, or I don't know, you know. Anyway, the question comes up, what should I tell my child about sex? And I always think, don't you know yet? I don't think, if I may be harsh, that any white American has a right to such innocence. If you don't know what action you should take to achieve full human dignity, God knows I can't tell you. And the second question, what specific action, et cetera, can the American Negro take to achieve full human dignity, is allied to the first. Because obviously, if you don't know what you should do to become a human being, you can't imagine what I should do to become a human being. And it is part of our dilemma that such questions can be asked. The question has to be asked of someone else, not of me, of you.
My son is 7 1/2 years old, a Negro. He thinks white people are greater than we are. What do I say?
That's a hard question. And again, I don't want to sound harsh. But it would seem to me that the question betrays a certain insecurity on the part of the woman or the man who asked it. If your child who's 7 1/2 thinks white people are greater than we are, it can't yet be because of white people, so it must be because of you. So the only way to answer your kid's question is for you, I suspect, to cease trying to be white.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. We'd like to thank Lorenz Graham for recording the James Baldwin speech back in 1963 for Pacifica Radio. If you would like to join our campus campaign sponsoring school libraries across the country, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the archives 1-800-735-0230. This program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, the American Archive, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, past grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and partnerships with UC Berkeley Moffitt Library, and from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our history alive.